Hey there, welcome to Board Game Hot Takes. My name's Tim.
And this is Chris.
This is Adam.
And today we're going to be giving our hot take on the game we just finished playing, Dune Imperium Uprising. But before we do, I do have some poll results to discuss. Frequently on the show, I'll ask a poll question on our social media channels. You can find us both on our Facebook group as well as on Blue Sky. And today I asked the question, what do you think about the amount of hobby board games that are being published each year? The options I gave on the poll were just the right amount, and that got 21%. There are too many, got 75%, and I want more, got 4%. How'd you guys answer this?
Whoa, I'm going to have to say too many. So I don't want to give Tim the satisfaction of being right on this one, but I'm going to say a lot of that comes from crowdfunding games. Frankly, it is just there's so much coming out that who can keep track of it? I mean, there's a lot of games coming out from recognized developers and designers. And even that, there's so much stuff happening that I can't keep track of it all. And I probably pay more attention than the average board gamer does to what's happening out there in the world because of the podcast, just like you guys do. And it just gets a little bit overwhelming after a little while. So if you take the crowdfunding out of it, it's a lot more manageable. But I think once you add that back in, it is just an absolute madhouse.
I put just the right amount on this one. But after thinking about it more, I kind of think that maybe there are too many. I'm going to try to take the side of just the right amount. And here's my argument. You look at books, and there's so many books from so many different authors all around the world coming out. And you don't try to read all the books. You hear about the good ones, and you find those, and maybe you start to read those. Or you have to be selective. You find the genre you like or a certain author that you like because of their prose or the way they do things. And you limit it to that author. You narrow your field. So right now we're in this bursting era of board games, and you have to narrow it down. And I enjoy that there's so many options. And I think that the good ones are, I have to limit down my scope to things that pique my interest right away. So I do that with artwork. I do that with certain designers that I like. I do that with mechanisms that I like. I'm starting to get a lot more selective with the board games that I'll even take a look at just because there are so many of them. So I think it might just be this sort of evolution of board games into the culture of people who care about board games. I don't know how to say that, but yeah, it's just a fledgling, maybe a natural evolution of a relatively newer art form. I don't know if that's the way to say it, but I hope you guys get a sense of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I would have said there are too many, but the more I think about it, I don't know who can judge that. Like, the fact is that, there are different games for different people, and every game isn't meant for every person. And so who could judge what's a good game and what should be published and what shouldn't be published? I think there are more than there. I think the problem is that there's such a saturation that any one gamer can't really even look at every decent game. And so there's probably a decent amount that a lot of soul gets put into a lot of artwork and creativity, and then they just get lost because there's so many games being published, and that's a shame. And I went to BGGCon a few weeks ago, and they had the hot games room, and I think there's 20 games featured in there where those are the biggest games laid on the table, and I'll never even get a chance to play half of those, at least probably. And I don't maybe half of those aren't made for me, so it's okay. Maybe there are other people that are really excited about those, but that's 20 out of the 3,000 published hobby games this year. So I think there is too many, but again, who's to say? I was thinking about Stonemaier Games, right? They're a publisher that we usually try to play most of their games. And when they published Wingspan, they published a first print run of 10,000 copies, because I think Jamie Stegmaier probably thought, well, we're taking a chance here. It's a nature theme game, something that hasn't been done much. It's a new designer. We'll make a small print run. Hopefully it's successful. And they sold out immediately, couldn't keep it in stock for years. It's now sold 2 million copies of that game. 2 years later, they published Pendulum, which was also a first-time designer, a game that got great reviews from playtesters. It's very interesting. And nobody's talking about that game anymore. And so, obviously Jamie Stegmaier's done pretty well. He's published some very popular games, but even he can't judge what is going to be a successful game or not. So I think a lot of the time publishers and designers, self-publishers, are kind of taking a stab in the dark and trying to figure out what's going to hit and what's not. And so a lot of them are going to miss, but maybe they miss because maybe Pendulum would have been bigger if there was 50 games or 150 games published that year instead of 3,000. I don't know. Anyway, I think there is too many being published, but I can't really gatekeep that and say like, well, this person shouldn't publish or this quality shouldn't be published or this weight shouldn't be published. I think, you know, the market's, I guess, going to just kind of work that out. Maybe it is. Some publishers have been folding recently, but the problem is it's like, it's a hobby. People want to be doing this because they enjoy being in part of the hobby. And I think people are going to keep doing it for the art of it and for the fun of it and not to make money. So maybe the market won't work it out and we'll just always have a ton of games and a few diamonds will shine every year.
So I feel like we're having a Freaky Friday moment here where I'm making the Tim argument and Tim's saying the things that I would have said a couple of years ago. But Tim, isn't that a pretty good argument that we have too many games? If there are great games out there that are getting kind of like lost in the chaff and the smoke of all these other things. And I mean, isn't that really the best argument that we do have too many?
No, it is. We have too many. I just don't think there's a solution for it. That's the point, because I think that the market won't fix itself because it's not all about money for a lot of the people that are making games. And I think the interesting thing about the hobby is that there are different people that like different things all across the board. So a lot of the games that get published that I may not have any interest in are going to find an audience. And so that's great that there's an audience, you know, like that people are finding the games that they want to get played. So I think there are too many games, but I don't know how to fix it. Like, I don't think there's a solution for it.
Okay. Are there too many movies because you haven't been able to watch every movie? Are there too many books because you haven't read every book? Are there too many video games because you haven't played every video game? Like, how do you decide what's too many and what's just right?
Yeah, it's a good point, Adam.
Well, I will tell everybody what should get published.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I'm joking. I mean, and it's funny because as we're talking about this, I'm kind of struggling with the analogy of books. I mean, I think, you know, you guys brought up books. And with books, there's all different, you know, varieties, but people consume books in a certain way. Like, you know, I read one, then I read the next one, I read the next one. So if I'm into sci-fi, I may just want to blast through everything that's sci-fi. I'm not even going to touch a whole other genre, you know, serious literature, or, you know, the things that people would consider serious literature these days, I suppose, is another thing. But we're not supposed to be, I don't think, consuming board games that way. I play a game once and boy, that was fun. I want to go play another game just like it. Games are an investment. Some of them cost, you know, $50, $60, $100, $200, depending on the type of game that it is. And so that's the kind of thing that you're not going to consume in the same way that you would a work of literature or a book, that kind of a thing.
Okay, to counter that argument, you look at a TV series like, I don't know, like The Expanse or Star Trek or, I don't know, 30 Rock, something you can go back to and watch over and over again. You catch something new every time you watch it. You find these different nuances. You find, oh man, this is what the writers were doing here in season two. I didn't notice that till my third time through because they're foreshadowing what's going to happen here in season five. So with any kind of work of art, I think it's worth going back to watch it again. Like The Arrival, you can watch that movie multiple times. And what is that? If you watch it three times, then you're in for 9 hours. How many board games get played 9 hours by one person? I don't know. I think there is an argument that can be made with books. Maybe not so much. You're not going to probably read it two, three times and go back to it again and again, but maybe so if it's something you love. But yeah, I can see your argument with books maybe not being there, but with some of these movies and TV shows, video games, I think there is some sort of analogous argument to be made for a lot of this media.
And I will just leave it by saying that The Expanse is not an argument for we should have The Bachelor.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
I think objectively there is bad TV. There are bad books. There are bad movies, and there are bad board games. Objectively, there are some bad ones. And I'll tell you what, Adam, you're about to like yell at me about this. I was walking through that BGG Con vendor hall, right? And there's some published board games out there that they're demoing that look cool, that have interesting mechanisms. And then there are like little self-published things that look like somebody made them on their kitchen table with paper and tape and pens and pencils. And maybe they're really excited about that, but I don't know that, like, it's the same thing as like making a home movie. There's like one or two in a decade that actually are quality enough to be worth exploring versus just taking up space in your Netflix browsing library and getting in the way of, you know, potentially finding other things. I don't know. I think there's bad stuff, but again, who can judge that? We can't be the judge of that.
Agreed. But Tim, I was not going to yell, and another strange twist of fate. I'm going to yell at Chris. You mentioned The Bachelor, The Bachelorette. They're for the right demographic, for the right demographic. That show is perfect. And, you know, you sit down and that's their favorite show. So I, you know, even The Bachelor, which could be horrible to you, Chris, is somebody's favorite show, I guarantee you.
So I will admit, you guys have kind of convinced me on this one. You've kind of brought me around to the idea that who can say what's too much, because who can judge what's right for somebody? I definitely have my own opinions on that one, but I can live with the fact that I shouldn't be deciding for other people what they should be able to play.
Yeah. I mean, I that's the key, right? We can't decide. I do think some publishers go overboard, like what Stronghold used to do, which was publish like 15 games a year. Basically anything that came across their desk, they'd throw a crappy production on it, put it out there. And once or twice they got a Terraforming Mars or a Great Western Trail. That was a huge success and that was their game. But it put a bunch of chaff out in the marketplace versus like Days of Wonder puts out one game a year. And most of them are huge hits. They're very beautifully produced. They're generally very solid games. Not every one of them has been a huge hit, but you know, I wish it was like more publishers were thinking like Days of Wonder versus Stronghold Games used to. But in any case, let's hear what some of our listeners had to think. So Tim Powell over on our Facebook group said, the more the better, as long as they take time to design, play test, graphic design, art, etc. While many games won't appeal to me, the more variety means a better chance of something that I'll enjoy. Aaron Freya said, some sites estimate there are 3,000 plus board games a year. Essen Schmiel listed 1,000 plus released at the convention. That's way too many games. When the Dice Tower can't even keep up with all the new games, you know there's a problem. Publishers need to limit themselves to one awesome game a year, like some publishers do, like Days of Wonder, which I just mentioned. And I mean, but like, there's no committee that's going to say, oh, you absolutely can't put out a second game this year or a third game. Like, who's going to do that? And, you know, if some publishers think the way they're going to make money, or publishers think, hey, these are a bunch of great games and it's a hobby for me and I can, you know, put out whatever I feel like, there's no way to regulate that other than, you know, if there was like a market force. But do we really just want money to be the driving factor in great games that could be interested in the market? Maybe there are some that don't seem marketable and they turn out to be super fun and interesting. So I don't know. Over on our Blue Sky account, Jason Greenberg said, it's just like movies. Every year, tons of movies get released. Not all are good. Some cater to specific audiences. Some aim for wide release and popularity. Not all hype is justified, while other hidden gems take longer to be discovered. I'm just happy if there are good new games to discover and play. And Marco said, my wallet and my shelves scream, too many, but my heart sings, never enough.
Nice.
So, yeah, it's interesting. And it seems like a good variety of opinions on this from our listeners as well. All right, well, let's jump into our discussion on Dune Imperium Uprising. Now, Dune Imperium Uprising is a standalone expansion for Dune Imperium. So we're not going to do a game description, because if you're interested in hearing a game description on Dune Imperium, you can go back to our episode on Dune Imperium where we featured that. But we're going to be talking about the expansion. You can just buy this. The whole game is in the box. It kind of includes all the mechanisms, all the components you need to play Dune Imperium. But it changes some things. It's got a new board. It's got new deck of cards, or a couple new decks of cards. And it's got some new components to interact with the new mechanisms. You could take all these things and mix it in with the base game, or you can just play it as a standalone game. So we'll, in our discussion, we'll end up chatting about some of the differences, some of the things that are unique with Dune Imperium Uprising. But let's jump right into the conversation.
So this game is like one of our perennial favorites. We have talked about Dune Imperium a whole bunch of times. We've done episodes on the different expansions. And so I was really interested to see how different things were going to be and how we felt about this particular expansion. But let me just go back for just a second, just to remind anybody who doesn't want to go back immediately and listen to our episode on the previous versions. just a quick reminder of the very, very basics of this game. It is a worker placement game that also has a deck building aspect to it, that you start with a base deck of a bunch of weak cards. Each card gives you benefits that you can use right away when you play the card. They give you a token on the card that lets you move one of your workers to a location based on which insignia are on that card. And then after you've used all of your workers, you end up doing a discard or a reveal hand where you get a different benefit at the very bottom of each card. And so you're putting your workers down. You're putting troops out on the board. There is a battle at the end of each round that gives you a bunch of bonuses usually, or points, or what have you. And then you also get an opportunity to buy new cards at the end of the round and enhance your hand so that you're not just playing with the basic cards. In that sense, it's one of the best versions of worker placement out there. It also happens to be one of the best versions of deck building out there. And so you put those two together and this is just a blast of a game. But we also want to focus today on the things that are different about this version than the previous versions. And that's, I think, where this game got really exciting, because there's a lot of new stuff in this, but enough familiarity with the old version, enough similarity that if you love the original version, then you're going to be able to jump right into this one and you're probably going to really enjoy this one as well. But the thing that jumped out to me the most as being really interesting, well, there was a couple, but I'll just focus on the first one, which is the spies. Spies are a mechanism in this game that's completely new. There was nothing like this in the previous versions, but a spy lets you put a special meeple out on the board in a certain spot. And there are spots between different worker placement areas. In some worker placement areas have their own spot. And once you put a spy out there, then that makes that spot always available to you, whether or not you have somebody that's already on that location, or if somebody else is already on that location. So in other words, that one is not blocked off to you anymore. No one can steal that one away from you, which is an amazing thing in this game, because like with so many worker placement games, the economy is tight here and the ability to take actions is tight. And a lot of times you may have someone who sees, yeah, Chris is going for this spot. He needs to put troops out. I need to grab that spot first so that I can get that benefit. He's going to be knocked out of it. If you got your spy there, then you still have that opportunity. And you also have the ability to use your spies for other things. So if you want to, you can pull a spy back, and that lets you put that. Well, that's one of the ways that you can put the meeple out there on a space that's already been taken. Or if you're just dying to get that one extra card that you haven't drawn, you can also pull back one of your spies on a space adjacent to your worker. And that lets you draw another card as well.
Yeah. So in this version of Dune Imperium Uprising, there's a lot of mechanisms that in some way echo or refine the mechanisms from the original Dune Imperium. And you said there's nothing like the spies. There is something that hints, they even call them spies in one of the expansions for Dune Imperium. And it's done in a different way, Chris. So it's actually on the card. It has like a little thing and it prevents your guy from being able to go to a space that's already occupied. And it's with one of the expansions and it's not on that many cards. So here you see a refinement of it in the spies that you're talking about. Another similar thing they did in this game is with the sandworms here. And in the expansion for Dune Imperium Original, you had the dreadnoughts, the big old dreadnoughts that would come along. They're worth a little more in combat. They kind of, you have to buy them, but once you have them, you have them. And if you want to combat with them, then they go away for a little bit. So here they refine that with these sandworms. So that's another new thing. They're worth three. And then if you win a battle with the sandworms, then you get double the reward for winning with that sandworm in it. So nothing like that with a double the reward, but a similar mechanism to those dreadnoughts using the sandworms here. And there was a couple other things that also refined that original Dune Imperium game, but I'll let Tim give his thoughts about those sandworms and the spies.
Well, the sandworms is interesting because, as you mentioned, if you win a combat with sandworms, or if you're even involved in a combat with sandworms and you get one of the rewards, you're going to get double on it. That's really cool. But they're one-time use. It's not like the dreadnoughts where they stick around after combat. Here, you get sandworms out there and they're gone at the end of the combat, but there's a big reward with them. But there's a little bit of restriction on it. One is that you first have to get one of these like maker hooks, I think they're called, but everybody can, you know, get one maker hook over the course of the game. Once you have them, then you can start recruiting the sandworms. You could choose to go down that path or you could completely ignore them. But another cool thing is that some of the battles where the biggest rewards are set in this city. And at the start of the game, the city has like a city wall up. And there's a couple ways in the game to break that wall down. And if you do it, then you can actually get your sandworms into the battle in those big cities as well. If you don't, you can't bring them in there. So when I read the rule book on this, I thought this was going to be a whole bunch of convoluted nonsense that really wasn't worth the rules explanation for it. And I was so wrong. I think it is such an interesting set of interconnected mechanisms that work here that make the combat more exciting on certain turns and people can drive to it. But unlike the dreadnoughts, it's not like the person who's just recruited a couple of dreadnoughts, you just kind of are like, okay, well, I'm just going to stay out of combat the rest of the game, right? This one, it's like, it's this constant escalation and back and forth and who can get to that recruiting sandworm space first this time, because now they've got a little extra bonus, a little heads up there. Another cool thing about the combat in this one was that there are these little symbols on the combat cards that was a little set collection mechanism. It's not always my favorite, but in this case, it's kind of neat. Everybody starts with one of these icons on a starting card. It's one of three icons. It's like this little sand mouse. There's like a thopter and then one other, a knife, I think, a Chris knife. And if you win a combat that has one of those symbols on the combat card, you also just get a bonus point. You flip over both the cards that match. So it was a really cool tension of like in the base game, if there is a conflict that doesn't have very interesting rewards, maybe it's just some Solari, everyone would hold back their troops. Maybe one or two people would get one or two troops in there just because they were kind of free, but you just ignore it. And this one, it's like every conflict had the potential for a point. Maybe you couldn't get it by that one match because it matched with your starting card, but if you got that one, maybe in a future conflict, you'd pick one up and get a bonus point for it. I really like that. I thought it really drove the tension, made it more interesting for different players every round about how impactful a combat was. It wasn't just about the conflicts that had the points in them. Somehow, they managed to take one of my favorite combat mechanisms in one of my favorite games and make it more exciting and make it more fun every turn. So between the worms, those icons, even the spies, Dune Imperium just got better with Uprising.
Tim, it's like magic. No, I completely agree with that about the different variations on combat here. And another thing they did that I think kind of plays into that same thing you were just talking about, Tim, is that the rewards for combat changed a little bit. Like there were actually a couple of combats that we saw where the second place benefit was actually a little stronger than the first place benefit. So you might have been 2 Solari first place, 3 Solari for second place. And that was a little bit of a nod to the idea that the person who gets first place is going to get fewer Solari, but they're also going to get that card and they're going to get that ability to get a point by having the icon in the top right of the card. And that was really cool. That was something that might drive you to go in one direction versus another in a combat and might make it important for somebody who might not otherwise be interested in that combat. They also, it felt like to me at least, that they made some more interesting benefits from the combat, even on the second and third place finishers. And those in particular could be very exciting if you happen to have a sandworm in the fight. There was actually a fight or two where I had a sandworm that was going in, and I was really kind of hoping to get the second place finish because the first might have been you get a point, or the first place might have been that you got to move up a track, which would normally be a super exciting thing to get. But I really needed Solari, and there was 2 Solari and a water droplet and a spice as the second benefit. And since I had a sandworm in the fight, I could have doubled all of those, and so it would have been this huge windfall. And then you guys didn't really challenge me on it, which I don't know if that was just you guys being brilliant, you know, crazy like a fox, or just weren't, you know, paying that much attention to what I was doing. But
you just had us scared.
But I, you know, it was, it really did drive a different approach to combat. So I might not be looking to get the first place win. I might be looking for that second place win, or I might be willing to settle for something less exciting in the first place win, because that's going to give me the opportunity for a point by taking the icon.
So the one thing about the combat that I am still on the fence about is those later combat cards, where you do have to do some work. And as I'm talking through it now, maybe I think it's pretty cool. You do have to do some work to get the shield wall down and then get a worm in there. But you could potentially get 4 points in one of these combats. So that seems like potentially a little swingy, but it is, like I just talked myself through it. It is going to take some work, because that shield wall has to be down for the city. The only combats, as far as I can tell, are for those three cities that are protected by that shield wall. Then they're able to get the worm in there to double those combat points, which is no more than 2 points per card that we saw. So that could be a 4 point swing, a 4 point combat in a game. I don't know how I was feeling about that, but as, like I said, as I talk myself through it right now, you do have to put some effort and a lot of resources into making that happen. So maybe it's worth it, but 4 points in one combat seems like quite a bit.
Yeah, but also notice that at least on the combat cards that we saw where there was a second point, there was a pretty big cost for it. Like the last conflict that I won, you had to have 4 spice for 1 point. So you would have had to have 8 spice to double that one, that, you know, to 2 points. And so, I mean, it was pretty heavy. Now, theoretically, you could actually get 5 points on that, because if it also matched the symbol on one of your other cards, you get 5 points in that combat.
Very true.
Now, I actually like this, okay, for two reasons. Number one is that it does allow the people that have fallen behind a little bit, and Student Imperium has always had this opportunity. There's always an opportunity for someone to get three, maybe 4 points in the last round or two with a couple slick moves. But this one really did give people a chance to catch back up. Like Chris was at 9 points going into that last round. I was at 8, and Steve was sitting down at 4 points. But theoretically, if he'd really set himself up there, he could have come almost all the way back, or maybe even all the way back in that last round. So I don't mind that. But the other reason I actually think I like it is that Dune Imperium, as much as I love it, has always run just a tad long. And I think there's a few ways that this game lets you finish a little bit earlier. Now there are some, what it looked like to us, at least on the intrigue cards, there was a number of new endgame points you could pick up in a variety of different ways. So that was a little bit more common. So maybe, you know, more special things that are going to happen in the conclusion of the game without taking away that excitement of the big final conflict, the big climax in the game. We ended on the 8th round, which most games of Dune Imperium, we usually end on the 9th or 10th round, but you know, so this was maybe a little bit early, but I think there was a few different ways to find points here. And that kind of leads to what else I really liked about this version of it, is that it seemed like right in this base box, there were several paths to go down, several routes. I was seeing many cards that gave you ways to get points. There were many, the factions themselves were very unique and gave you different ways to drive down. And so I think this almost felt like the experience that I got out of playing Dune Imperium with Rise of X, where you had a few different paths to go down. You didn't have to focus on conflict. You don't have to focus on, you know, one or two specific, you could focus on those Chome things. And let me talk about that. Actually, the Chome module was really cool. This is something that they kind of put in there as like an add-in module. You could leave out if you want to, but these are little mini objectives that you could pick up on a couple spaces. And then if you went to a space on that little objective card you got, you'd get a bonus for it. So that was another thing that you could really focus on heavily. And then there were other cards that gave you bonuses for completing more of those goals. So just felt like a very like nice mix of different paths to go down, different routes to go down in this one box. I really liked really everything that this expansion brought in, all the new kind of features that are coming in here. I didn't expect to. I read the rule book and I said, there's a couple things that are just adding clunkiness, adding extra stuff, but I was wrong. Everything felt like it worked really well.
Yeah. You know, one of the things they added in, or maybe this wasn't an add, it was more of a change, was there was a new set of worker placement spaces. And I actually thought the worker placement spaces were better in this version of the game than in the previous versions. And in part because it gave you more opportunities. It gave you different routes to get things, and it gave you different routes to spend things that you'd already gotten. Like, there were more opportunities in particular to use Solari. Like, I thought that was one of the most frustrating things about the original one, is that you get this huge amount of Solari and there's a couple things you want to do with it right at the beginning. Like, you want to go to the Sword Master and get your extra worker, or I forget what the other ones were, but there wasn't a whole lot. And once you got to the end of the game, you might have an engine built up where there's a bunch of Solari, but you didn't really have any good way to spend it. Here, there were a couple of worker placement spaces that let you use them to put out troops or, you know, various things like that. And I thought that those kinds of opportunities were much more varied in this version than in the previous versions. And it goes beyond the Solari. There were other things in there too. But I thought that it was more well-rounded in that sense, that it was more difficult to block someone from doing some basic things. There were more opportunities to use things that you were able to, you might not otherwise have a use for. And between that and the spies, it really did kind of open things up. So it felt like the ecosystem was a lot more forgiving than in some previous editions of this game.
Chris, I think you hit the hammer on the nail with the cookie crumbles. You hit the nail on the head with that one. You called it right, especially when you said there's a lot more ways to use the Solari, not just on the worker placement space, but a lot of those intrigue cards let you do it. And there's a lot more ways to get Solari. There's just so many refinements on the original Dune Imperium, I think, were fantastic work. So you talk about the worms, we talked about the spies. One thing we didn't talk about was the Mentat in the original. Really, game, you send your guy out and you get this extra worker. Now there's just a space where you put your guy in it, you pay 3 Solari, you get to exchange an entry card, and you get to draw a card, and you get to recall one of your other workers instead of gaining a Mentat. How slick is that? So it's basically the Mentat space without including this extra little doohickey. And so I thought that was a nice little cleanup. One thing we didn't talk about was the contracts. There's contracts in this game. There's 2 spots you can go to. One of them is that bottom spot, the lesser spot on the Emperor Alliance or Allegiance track over there in the top left portion of the board itself. And it lets you pick up this little contract. And when you subsequently go to one of these spaces later on in the game, you get some little bonus, whether 3 Solari, a couple spice, you get to do something cool, or you go one of the, I don't know. So just these little simple, easy to get bonuses by going to this Emperor spot that wasn't too spicy in the previous version of the game. So I thought that was a nice fix. I said it before, I don't know if it was the last episode or a couple episodes ago, I think it was the mailbag one, that I wanted to hate this game or at least think it was a crappier version of Dune Imperium, but I can't do that. It's an excellent version. You almost get everything that you found. I'm kind of going to final thoughts here, but why not? Everything that you found in the original Dune Imperium with the expansions, it kind of encompasses all of that feel for me here in a more streamlined kind of way. Going back to the original game with those 2 expansions, it feels like you got too much stuff, like it's a little bit bloaty. As much as I enjoy the game with those expansions, this kind of does all of that with a lot less stuff.
Well, Adam, I did actually talk about those contracts. That's the Chome module I was talking about, but it's okay. I often fall asleep while I'm listening to myself as well. So,
yeah, I wasn't listening to you, so that's why I didn't know.
So let's jump into the theme and production before I get to my final thoughts. I don't want to jump the gun like Adam did here. First of all, this looks like Dune Imperium. So if you've seen Dune Imperium, it's not going to change anything really. Like, the card art's pretty similar. The graphic design is pretty similar. Everything looks the same. One interesting choice is that they included these sandworms in there, and they include both a plastic miniature version, but also a meeple version, which I think is pretty cool since they already made the original Dune Imperium and you've got all these, you can get this upgraded plastic miniature kit with it. Well, if you've got that, then of course you want the plastic worms. But if you've got all meeples, well, plastic worms feel a little weird on the board. So they kind of made it flexible and usable by anybody. And I think that was a smart touch by them. Otherwise, I'll just talk a little bit about the fact that it's a standalone expansion, which was an interesting choice that I didn't understand at first, but I think I'm coming around to why they did it. And that is that if they just wanted to give you an expansion, they should have just provided another board a new set of cards and the couple little mechanisms, the sandworms and the couple other pieces that you need to include in here. And to me, that would have made a lot of sense as somebody who owns Dune Imperium. But the reality is the only thing that would be missing then is the little cubes and the player, you know, the meeples. And so why not make it a standalone version, especially since this game works so great without anything else? Like, you don't need any of the other expansions. I kind of agree with Adam that this kind of replaces it. It gives enough variety in this one box, in this one kit, that's why we needed expansions originally. That's why Rise of Ix was so important to me, because you needed different paths to go down. You need different, you know, variety in there. And this, I feel like, gives enough variety right in the box. I think so it's an interesting choice. My understanding is that you can't fit this in the original Dune Imperium box, the large box with the inserts and everything in there without some lid lift. That's a little bit of a pain. I bet you could probably fit it in the original Dune Imperium box if you just threw out the cardboard insert that was in there. So, you know, it kind of all fits. I guess it's kind of nice that they made this so that if somebody doesn't already have Dune Imperium, they can still jump into the game at this entry point. But it kind of comes back to our conversation in the mailbag last week, which is they just finished making Dune Imperium and Immortality and Rise of Ix. Now they've just put out a new refined version. I said last week, I thought that was great. Now I don't like it because I've got all that stuff, but I kind of just want to be playing this version of it. And I don't know. It's an interesting choice. What do you guys think about the fact that they made this a standalone expansion?
I'm going to make up a new word for it. It's a maximal expansion. So I'm going to call it a max expansion. Bam. Take that, world.
Board game world has just been shocked by Chris's
expansion.
Addition to that doesn't roll off the tongue at all. I mean, yeah, I am still struggling a little bit to really understand standalone expansion versus just it's an updated version of the game. It's a version 2.0. So I'm going to say I don't really think it's an expansion. I think it's really just a version 2.0 of this game.
Yeah.
Okay. This is what, I mean, Paul Dinan and Direwolf Games does, right? With the Clank, they've done similar things. Could you compare those two, or is it like, I don't know, like Brass 2 with Brass Lankit, Cashire and Brass Birmingham? Those are kind of variations. There's a lot of games that come out with just different maps. Terraforming Mars even has the different maps. It's not a different game, but there's a lot of game, Age of Steam, whatever that's called, the Railways of the World. All these games have like their different maps and they're all standalone / kind of expansions, but with little tweaks here and there. So it's not the weirdest thing of all, but
yeah, I mean, the reality is you could mix in the other expansions. Like, if you really like the shipping track in Rise of Ix, you could add that in. If you really like, well, the technologies actually in Rise of Ix is kind of an interesting thing that you don't have here. So if you want to add that variety, you can add it in. You could also add the Immortality expansion if you want that extra deck building with the, you know, with the little axolotl cubes or whatever, the grafting and all that stuff. You can add that in. So In a way, it's not just a replacement because it does allow you to play with most of the other components. And if you really just want a ton of variety, if you play this game a ton, then mix in a lot of the stuff in the base deck, mix in the stuff from the expansions, and you're going to get a huge epic game that just is going to play out completely different every time. So I think, you know, it was an interesting choice. I don't know. I'm on board with it. I'll get to my final thoughts and talk a little bit more about that. But, from a production perspective, it was definitely something I haven't seen a lot.
If you added in all those other pieces, imagine the battles you'd have with like troops versus sandworms versus dreadnoughts. That'd be pretty cool. I would want to check that out. One thing I did want to talk about, and this is back at the micro level, but I thought it was really neat. You mentioned before, Tim, the city with the wall. I actually thought that thematically that was a really interesting thing. I thought it was thematically interesting having the sandworms in there in the first place and that you had to get that hook to be able to use them. But having it so that they couldn't get into the city until the wall had been taken down, I actually thought thematically that was a really neat thing to do. And like you, when I was reading the instruction manual on this one, or at least in particular to this piece, I'm like, what? I don't get that. It's going to be weird. But then I looked at it on the board and they've actually got the wall sitting there on the board with the little city kind of separated out and looking kind of cool, looking like a little city, looking like its own little separate area. And all of a sudden it made sense to me. And all of a sudden I'm thinking, wow, this is actually really neat. And it does tell the story better than it did without that. So I like that. I thought that was a pleasant addition to the game thematically.
To talk about what you were talking about earlier, Tim, about combining this all together, there are some notes in the back of the rule book about how you can add the different expansions that exist for Dune Imperium, the original already, and combining with the base game. So while that is nice, it also is confusing. Like, what am I supposed to do? Like, how should I play this game? And I guess as you get more familiar with it, people are going to have more ideas about what works well and what doesn't work well. So that could be fun, or it could be a little bit overwhelming. Right now it's at the overwhelming stage for me, but I'm sure with more and more plays of this, if I get more and more plays of this, there'll be a favorite way to combine everything up. And Chris, you're already talking about with Dreadnoughts versus Sandworms and stuff. That sounds pretty cool. I hope there's a way to get that done that works well.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's jump into our final thoughts. And the final question I'll ask is, would you request to play this again? It's an easy answer for me. I will be requesting to play it again. I think this was my favorite way to play Dune Imperium, and it's one of my favorite games of all time. So I'd say that I've got a strong recommendation that if you don't own Dune Imperium and you were thinking about picking it up, or you like Dune Imperium and you don't own it, just buy this version of it as a starting point. And if you really love it, then you could add more expansions into it. It's interesting. Do I need this? I mean, like, if I buy this, will I ever play the base board again? I don't think I would. I think I like everything that gets added into this board that I'd probably always play with this board. Although I would probably try adding in Rise of Ix or some elements of it. I'd probably try adding in the Immortality expansion as well to just provide a lot more variety here. So I think it's likely I will pick this up. I'm not going to throw out my old Dune Imperium because I've got all the other expansions, and it may even be fun at some point to just like mix in a whole bunch of the base deck stuff. I will say that if you buy this standalone, I think it solved almost every minor complaint I had about base Dune Imperium. There's a variety of directions to go. The card market seems more varied, more interesting than the base deck card market does. It just, everything about it just added to the excitement of the combats, the climax. It shortened the game a little bit, at least it did in this gameplay, and I think that's a good thing for Dune Imperium. I just liked everything about how this play went for one of my favorite games. So I think it's an excellent revision, kind of an expansion, whatever you want to call it. I think it's awesome. I'll probably pick this up, put it in my big deluxe edition box in with everything else. The base game board will probably never come out again, but I loved it. This is the way I'd want to be playing Dune Imperium.
So I'm not going to answer the question straight out. I'm going to keep you in suspense. But I never bought a copy of Dune Imperium with you guys because you guys all have Dune Imperium. I didn't need to buy it. I would just, if I'm playing with you, one of you would bring it. And then somebody in my local game group got it. So when I was playing with my local game group, I never needed to own a copy of it. There I am, happy as a clam, not having to spend the, I don't know what, $50, $70 or whatever it costs to buy Dune Imperium because everybody already has this thing and I'm just, you know, playing it for free and that's great. But now that I've played Dune Imperium Uprising, I do need to go buy it because I'm not playing that crappy, outdated garbage you guys have anymore. Wow. No, this was a highly optimized version of Dune Imperium. I absolutely loved it. I think this is one of the most fun plays of Dune Imperium that I've had yet. It didn't feel bloated. It, with all the expansions, it felt, like I said, it felt optimized. It felt like somebody fine-tuned this thing and made it just as streamlined as could be, all in one nice, neat little package. And I think I'm just going to need to get this one.
I won't keep anybody suspense. I would request to play this one again. Am I going to pick it up? I don't think so. I'm so invested. This is like the sunken cost thing or whatever. I'm pretty invested in the old one. And I still have tons of fun playing though. I have a nice mat. So everything is clean and it doesn't feel as bloated as having all these sideboards and stuff. So I have a nice clean mat to play on. That last play we had, Tim, when you were here playing, we got about halfway through the game before we had to bail on it. It was so tense, so fun. I love the immortality and the Ix expansions together with the base game. There's still a lot there for me to explore. I was still finding new ways to use it. There's going to be an infinite way to use all these cards together with the craft mechanism to do different things throughout the game. We were both taking different strategies that last game, and we were countering each other well. We both had an opportunity to win, and it was just as tense as I could ever want it to be. So that original old school Dune Imperium is still a fantastic game, and Dune Imperium Uprising is also a fantastic game. I'm not going to turn down a game of either one anytime soon. Looking forward to playing them both many, many times in the future.
Nice. Well, that's the way to go. So when we're in Long Beach, we play old school Dune. When we're in Portland, we play Dune Imperium Uprising. And who knows what we'll be playing in my house. I don't know. All right, cool. Well, thanks. That will wrap up the conversation on Dune Imperium Uprising. Let's jump into a couple of games that have been on our table right after this. All right, welcome back. What have you guys been playing this week?
So what's on my table is not actually on my table yet, but it's something I'm super excited about putting on my table very soon. About 6 months ago, I was at my local game store here, Mox Boarding House, which you guys know well and is probably the greatest board game store I've ever been to. And I picked up a copy of Clank Acquisitions Incorporated, which is probably one of the most fun gaming experiences that I've ever had. A few years ago, when we were both relatively new to the hobby, Tim and I played through a full campaign of that, and it was so much fun, so enjoyable. Since my wife has gotten more into board games, and she has played Clank before and enjoyed the couple of plays that we'd had, I thought this would be an absolutely awesome opportunity to get this one, get it played, and get it played in a way where I could actually make it all the way through the full campaign, which I would absolutely love to do. And I would love to do it with my wife, because I think that'll be a lot of fun. This game has one of the best senses of humor that I've ever seen, like actually laughing aloud, reading some of the little story points to this game. So much fun. But that was 6 months ago, and it is so hard to get a new game played in my house because nobody likes learning new games, that I feel like it's finally going to happen. And the reason is because it's my birthday coming up this week, and on my birthday, they have to do what I say, and I'm going to say we need to play Clank Acquisitions Incorporated. That's all I want for my birthday, all I want for Christmas, other than my two front teeth, is to play more of Clank Acquisitions Incorporated. So wish me luck. I'm not sure anybody will actually capitulate to that, but I'm going to ask for it, and we'll see if it actually happens.
Well, good luck, Chris, and a happy early birthday to you.
Thank you.
On my table, my dad was here for Thanksgiving. We had a chance to play a few games. I mentioned Planet Unknown last week, and we also had a chance to play one of my favorite games of all time, Innis. This is by Christian Martinez and with a couple of fantastic artists here, Dimitri Bilak and Jim Fitzpatrick, who does the covers for these games and this kind of psychedelic, beautiful artwork. Absolutely love the artwork here. So yeah, I convinced my dad to play this one with me. He's played it before, so we went back to it. He remembered some of the cards and this, that, the Geist card. We were having fun with that. That's the one that kind of cancels out a card that you're playing. If you don't know Innis, there's a small deck of these green cards. I think in a two-player game, you have 6+6+1, whatever that ends up being. Somebody help me out with the math there. It's not that many.
13.
13? So there's 13 cards that you're using, and you have these little drafts that go back and forth. So you get super familiar with this small hand of cards, but there's the one card that doesn't get drafted every round. So you're not quite sure, you know, what that one card is that's hidden over here. Is it going to be that sneaky card that you don't want your opponent to have? Well, I don't know. So you're playing cards back and forth. You're putting guys out on these Are they tessellating? They're these funky territories. They can fit in all these different ways. They are so unique. They're not, you know, they're not rectangular. They're not hexagonal, and they can fit together in these crazy ways. Anyway, so you're building this territory as the game goes along. You're adding sanctuaries as the game goes along. You're adding these citadels as the game goes along. You're adding more troops out there, and you're trying to get present in six territories, or be present in lands with six sanctuaries, or be chieftain over six of your opponent's troops. So, you know, if you have four troops in land and they only have three, then you're the kind of the boss of those troops. And same thing, if you have four troops in another land and they only have three there, then you're boss of six of your opponent's troops. So that's the three win conditions: present in six lands, present in lands with six territories, or chieftain over six of your opponent's troops. So it's back and forth and back and forth. You have this emergent gameplay. You're able to draw into your hand these super powerful cards with, again, another set of amazing artwork. I still haven't seen all of these red cards that are in the game. Once you're in a position to win, you have to sort of announce it with an action. It's like almost like a check in chess. So you're like, hey guys, watch out, I'm in a position to win, can you stop me? Or, you know, did I do it late enough in the round that you don't have enough time to stop me? You can also just pass and preserve your cards if you want to, you know, sort of have everybody else run out of their cards, and then you can make your move at the end of the game. So timing is a big deal with this game as well. Anyway, we had a lot of fun playing Innis. I absolutely adore this game. This is one that's been on a slow climb up. It was outside of the top 100 on BoardGameGeek for the last few years, and now it's sitting at 97, and it keeps slowly climbing up as more and more people discover the brilliance and fantasticness of this game, like I'm hoping you guys will at some point in your lives. You guys are still the ones keeping it down in the, trying to keep it sub 100, but someday you guys will come around and you'll get those votes for this game to climb up higher and higher and higher. That's Innis, a board game I absolutely love playing and don't get to play enough. And that's why I force it on my dad when he's in town.
Adam, did the game overstay its welcome, or did it end in a reasonable amount of time?
No, not at all. The ending came up quick. I've never had this game overstay its welcome. I've heard that complaint before. There's an expansion that allegedly handles that problem that I've never seen, but maybe it's just because I haven't played the game enough.
That's cool. We should play it. I don't know. Maybe we should do a feature review on it one of these days when we're doing a game night. We don't have anything else going. I mean, we should all jump on and play a 4-player game of it.
It's quick, man.
We haven't.
No, we played it before.
I feel like
we played it together on our game night before we started the podcast. Oh. So we got a chance to play it, and it just wasn't a huge hit for 3 out of 4 of us, and so we just never went back to it. But yeah, I would like to revisit it at this point. Adam loves it. Maybe we give it a shot at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm willing to play it, and why not do it? I had this weird connection in my mind, probably because we played them around the same time, Innis and Hyperborea, and I really didn't care for Hyperborea.
That's funny. Yeah. Those were two that we played in person, and yeah. I loved Hyperborea. You never were a fan of, which is always so strange to me, because it was like a nice little Euro with area control going on in it. Maybe you'd like it more now, Chris.
Maybe.
You know what? I think that's, we got to do a doubleheader, Innis and Hyperborea back to back.
Let's do it.
Well,
that sounds good. Great.
Glad you had fun with that, Adam. So what's been on my table this week is holiday themes. Since we're coming up into the holidays, I'll talk about it a little bit here. Do you guys like escape rooms? Have you been to any like full-fledged in-person escape rooms?
Never done one.
Yes.
You
I love them.
And have you guys ever played any of the escape room in a boxes, like Unlock or Exit? Chris, you played one with me a few years back, I know. But
yep.
Adam, have you ever played
one? I have 3 or 4 exits. I broke one of them out and started trekking my way through it, and it seemed cool, but then I don't know, I got distracted by a kid or renovations or something and never finished it off.
So I played quite a few of them. My wife and I do them once in a while, and the nice thing about it is like you know, it's an hour. You're not going to spend more than an hour with it. So when we've got kind of an afternoon, we're like, yeah, let's do something a little unique. We'll bust out. I've got, you know, a handful of them, and we'll just bust one out and play it. And they're pretty fun. But I think there's an element of even real escape rooms that they, you know, like they try to fit all these puzzles in this one situation or even in this one box. And some of the puzzles are fun. They're fun to, they're interesting challenges. They make you feel smart when you solve them. And then there are some that are just unsolvable. And that's been true with real escape rooms most of the time. It's been true with escape room in boxes most of the time. Anyway, so there's Inc. and Marcus Brand, who make the Exit series. They release an advent calendar, an exit advent calendar. And I knew this came out a couple of years ago. I was thinking about getting it, but I was like, Danielle, you know, she's going to think, Tim's just forcing board games on me all the time. So I never picked it up. Well, she decided that this would be a fun thing for our family to do. So she ordered it. We received our copy on December 2nd. So the day we got it, which was Saturday, we got to do two of the games right in a row. And it's pretty clever. It's a typical, looks like a you know, an advent calendar where it's like kind of a big box. One of the ones you might find today that has chocolates in it or little bottles of whiskey or something like that, right? It's a big cardboard box with a fold down flap and a bunch of little doors that you have to open up. But it also comes with a book, and the book tells you a little bit about the rules, you know, how you're going to go about interacting with the puzzle. But then it has some story in there. So the first, you know, it introduces you to the story. This one is called Exit the Game Advent Calendar, The Mystery of the Ice Cave. That's, well, that's the one we've got. I guess this was released in 2020, but I think there's a couple of versions of it. The story starts out right at the beginning. You're out skiing, an avalanche happens, you get trapped in a cave. Okay, that's, you learn that in the first page of the back of the box will tell you that. You learn in the first page of the book. So you're basically in this room, you got to get out of it. So you open the first compartment and you get some components in there, which are pieces of this puzzle. There's also a page of story that you can look at. It might be something you interact with. But also inside this little door in the advent calendar is a scene. And so some of the clues you might get are within that scene as well. We have now done 3 days on this. I'm not going to give any spoilers, but I will just tell you that every one of the puzzles has been fun. Every one of them has been solved in a reasonable amount of time, maybe 5 to 10 minutes. So we were never stuck there just sitting forever. The second of the puzzles that we did so far got us a little bit stuck, almost to the point where my wife was like, should we look at the clue book? And I said, no, not yet. And then 30 seconds later, we figured it out. So we've gotten all three of them. That's good. That's a good sign. And I'm excited to go back to more of them. So Exit the Game Advent Calendar, The Mystery of the Ice Cave by Inca and Marcus Brand. So far, a blast with it. I might report back after the holidays to let you know if the whole thing turned out fun. But this is probably my favorite way to explore one of these escape rooms in a boxes so far. Nice little tidbits, little you know, one little puzzle at a time, and really having fun with this one.
It's so funny that you brought that up, Tim, because we discovered these last year, and so we are on our second one.
Oh, nice.
This year.
Okay.
Yeah, we've actually got one of the exit ones this year. It's not the ice caves, it's the Silent Storm. The idea there is that there's a big, huge storm at the, it's actually at the South Pole, strangely enough, at Santa's workshop, and there's an emergency system that goes into place, and you're one of the elves trying to, like, work his way from the wherever he got locked in when the emergency system came on to Santa's office so that they can get everybody freed out again. But super clever, lots of fun, love doing these.
Nice. That's cool. So did you do the Ice Cave one last year, Chris, or did you do a different one last year?
No, we did one that I believe was from Ravensburger last year. I forget who made the one we did last year. It was a sunken submarine one,
okay,
which wasn't very Christmassy, but it was still done as an advent calendar. This one is by Exit.
Nice. All right. Very cool. I've got one more quick thing I'm going to just mention, but this is a game that we're all going to be playing together at some point. We've been talking about it for years. I got a chance to play The Quest for El Dorado this week. This is a Reiner Knizia game, and I promise you that this is a Reiner Knizia game that even Chris could love. This is a pretty simple little deck builder game with exploration. It's a race. So basically, you have these big hex tiles on the board that have a whole bunch of different terrain types on them. You have a starting deck of cards like every deck, good deck builder does, where they give you some options. You can move through forest, or you can move through water. You can spend money to buy more cards. You basically play these cards down, you move through the terrain you can afford to, and you buy more cards from a market at the end of the turn. turns go quickly, but it's fun little races. Sometimes you get blocked up by terrain that requires more canoe paddles than you've got, or more machetes than you've got, and you can't get past them. A fun little mechanism about trying to get over thresholds between these big tiles quicker and get a bonus, which is the tiebreaker at the end of the game. But basically, as soon as someone gets to the end, they win. If that round finishes and they're the only one that got there, the game's over. There's no scoring. There's no points. If two people get there, there's a simple little tiebreaker with it.
There's no wacky scoring condition if you have the most of this, but didn't have the most of this, and then you divide by the square root of...
Nothing. Nothing like that. Nothing that feels like a Reiner Knizia game other than it's simple, straightforward. And I picked up the first edition of this. There was a recent second edition, like reprint of it that, you know, they updated the artwork. But, you know, I always thought this looked kind of ugly when I saw pictures of it, but it actually is quite a pleasant production. It looks very colorful. The artwork on the cards is nice, and it looks really pretty out on the table. It looks cool out on the table. And so I picked up the first edition just because I was at a seller's market. Somebody was selling it for $15 because they just bought the second edition to replace it. I love it. It's fantastic. I had a blast playing this. Literally, like, taught four people. The four of us played it, and I think we were done in 30 minutes. I think this is going to be a 20 to 40 minute game max with a full player count. Really, really fun. I'm excited to go back to this one. I'll definitely bring this to our next game weekend, and you guys will get a chance to play it. I think you'll have a blast with it.
So this is the one and only Reiner Knizia game that I really actually do want to play, and not just to be ironic. Yeah. So I'd love to try it.
Cool. Well, I think you'll like it. We'll have to do it.
Also looking forward to this one very much. Nice. Let's do it.
All right. Well, I think that will wrap up this episode. I hope you all enjoyed. If you enjoy the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. Also, feel free to join us on our Facebook group or on Blue Sky. If you need a Blue Sky invite, drop me an email at tim@boardgamehottakes.com. We've had 100 listeners reach out for invites over the last month or so since I've been talking about this. Tons of people joining us over there. Great community building up. Lots of fun conversations happening on Blue Sky as well as our Facebook group. So join us either platform or both, and we'd love to have you. Until next week, take care, everybody.
Good night, all.
Bye-bye.